May it please the Court, John Fiorello of Archer & Greiner, appearing on behalf of the defendant appellant, SPX Corporation. This is a case arising out of the vacation of an arbitration award by the Chancellor in issuing his final report, essentially on the basis that the arbitrator so imperfectly executed his duties by ignoring the clear dictates of the contract before him, imperfectly performed his duties, and the award should be vacated. We submit, Your Honor, that the Chancellor did not consider all of the possible bases for the award, and that even on the basis that the Chancellor announced with respect to the interpretation of the contract, that his focus was too narrow, and that the contract does permit, within the broad latitude permitted, the discretion of an arbitrator, the result which was apparently reached.
Before you get into it, am I correct in understanding that the arbitrator gave no explanation for the numbers he came up with?
That's correct. It was a summary award which was provided for in the underlying arbitration agreement as well as in the statement of work between the parties and the arbitrator.
So the fact that there would be no analysis of I looked at this, I looked at that, I rejected something, that was not unexpected by the parties?
Not at all, Your Honor.
And that being the case, how is it that anyone is able to conclude what the arbitrator read into any provision in the underlying document?
Your Honor, all we can do is to consider what was before the arbitrator in the record, certain questions asked by the arbitrator, and attempt to infer from that what the arbitrator may have been thinking or considering. But in terms of do we know for sure what the arbitration award was based on, based on the award that was rendered, I'd have to say no. The history of the arbitration is...
Just to follow up on that, the Vice Chancellor set the award aside on the theory that the arbitrator specifically did something that was inconsistent with the unambiguous language in the contract.
That was his view, yes, Your Honor.
So how do we get from a general award without specificity to a reversal based on a specific improper consideration?
By inference. That's the only way that the Vice Chancellor inferred what the arbitrator must have been thinking from our perspective, decided that that violated the contract and therefore vacated the award. The arbitration sort of had its genesis in December 31, 2005, that it comes out of a dispute of a reserve account calculation on a stock purchase agreement. The agreement was effective December 31st. The closing was early January. The purchaser, Garda, timely noticed its dispute about this particular item.
So this is a set-aside for workers' compensation claims?
Yes, Your Honor. It was a workers' compensation reserve in the effective day balance sheet, which ultimately affected the net working capital, which had an ultimate impact on the purchase price.
So you said, according to Chantry's decision, was based on an inference. Is there any other reasonable inference than the one that the Vice Chancellor reached?
We believe so, Your Honor. The first one is...
Just to refine the question a little bit, because I have the same concern. In answering that question, could you tell us whether you believe the phrase in the relevant contract provision that generated the result that you're appealing from is ambiguous or unambiguous? And secondly, if it's unambiguous, as the court found, whether the other inferences that you contend that we can draw require reading that unambiguous provision in connection with some other provisions of the contract?
Yes, Your Honor. There were essentially three provisions of the agreement which, in SPX's view, allowed it to do exactly what it did. Where this came out of is SPX did not maintain workers' compensation reserves at the subsidiary level, which was sold, maintained them at the corporate level. It did not include IBNR, incurred but not revealed claims, in its reserve calculations ever. Its practice was to use just the insurance company's case reserves for each of the claims which had been filed. And that's what resulted, and I don't think there's any dispute about that, that the reserve that was ultimately appeared in the effective date balance sheet of $1.366 million was the sum of those case reserves. What happened between the time the reserve was created and the time the arbitration was heard was that all of the claims that existed on the date of closing closed, and the actual claim payments were $1.232 million out of the $1.366 reserve. So that when the arbitrator was presented with the case, the arbitrator was presented with a situation where the reserve had already been determined by events, and the reserve in fact proved to be greater than the amount of the claims. Now, returning to the contract, which is the question you asked originally, the offer to purchase was based upon a September 30, 2005 balance sheet. The SPA provided that an estimated balance sheet would be created as of closing and an effective day balance sheet within 60 days after closing. The contract required SPX to use the same methodology in creating the closing day balance sheet as it did for the September 30, 2005 balance sheet. And that's contained in the SPA section 1.3A. In SPA section 1.3C, that provides that in preparing the effective day balance sheet from the closing day balance sheet, SPX will use the same estimates methodology that it used historically to create the closing day balance sheet. The controversy arises that there is an exhibit to the SPA, which is the seller's disclosure statement. And specifically section 1.3 of the seller's disclosure statement. That says in section 1.3C, this contains the same language about SPX being permitted to continue to use its same methodology in the creation of accounts and in reserves. The rub is that in section 1.A, small Roman numeral 5, that seems to require that IBNR not necessarily be included in any reserves for casualties other than workers' comp reserves. And that's what I think Vice Chancellor Lasher's problem was, that because the arbitrator did not change the amount of the workers' compensation reserve, Vice Chancellor Lasher decided that the arbitrator must not have included IBNR in the reserve as he was required to under section 1.3A5 of the seller disclosure statement. We submit to Your Honor that I don't believe that those provisions are irreconcilable, and I think there is a legitimate difference of opinion as to whether one trumps the other provision. I do. Vice Chancellor Lasser seemed to think that if you applied it one way, you could reconcile them. I don't see that, but that was his decision. But that's only one presumed or one inferred way that the arbitrator decided this case. Because you have to remember that the arbitrator had before him and asked questions and asked for additional evidence about the fact that the historical claims had all been paid and that they were less than the actual reserve that he was being asked to increase by between $2.5 and $2.9 million. GARDA supported that assertion by producing an actuarial report, which basically concluded that the IBNR that should have been applied, if you included IBNR in the reserve account, would have increased it by $2.5 to $2.9 million. The arbitrator had the complete right to reject that evidence in its entirety and to conclude that an actuarial report given today that tells me that the reserve should have been $3.9 million 5 years ago is not worthy of consideration when, in fact, the actual claims were less than the reserve. So history proved the reserve to be correct, and history also provided the arbitrator for a basis, even if he wanted to include IBNR, to reject the only evidence before him on an amount of what IBNR should be.
Can I stop you there because I'm a little bit confused? I understand the gist of what you're saying being that there was a reserve of $1.3-something million for workers' comp claims that over time, by the time it got to arbitration, everybody knew that those claims had been paid and that it came to $1.2 million or some amount that was slightly less than what the reserve was, right?
Correct.
Okay, so here's the question. IBNR, doesn't that move forward so that even if as of today all the claims have been paid, there could be more claims coming up that nobody knows about yet?
In theory.
But isn't that what the reserve is for? Maybe I should reword the question. The fact that the reserve was more than adequate for what the claims were up to the point that the arbitration took place doesn't necessarily mean that the reserves shouldn't have been higher because moving forward there are going to be more claims. Or am I missing something?
I hate to resort to this. All things are possible, and that's theoretically possible.
Why is it unlikely?
It's unlikely because the transaction, these are workers' comp reserves.
Right.
As of December 31st, no more claims could arise against this reserve.
Why not?
Because GARDA assumed liability for all workers' compensation claims arising after the date of closing. Okay. So you would only...
All right, so let me make sure I understand this then. GARDA sought this arbitration because it was of the view that the claims, that the reserve was insufficient, right?
That's correct.
And by the time it got to arbitration, the actual result was that the reserves were sufficient.
Yes, Your Honor.
Didn't that make the whole thing moot?
GARDA's position, and I'm sure Mr. Symes will argue this far more eloquently, is that the agreement required the reserves to be calculated as of that date.
Right.
So you go back to that date, and as of that date, what are you looking at going forward? And that was precisely a question that the arbitrators asked. They raised the issue in the post-submission questions. Well, essentially, whether the arbitrator could consider the historical facts or whether and look at the reserves today and the situation today versus having to go to look backwards to the date of the agreement. And
I assume you differed on what the arbitrator should do in that regard, right?
Well, we weren't asked the question, Your Honor. So we didn't really respond to it, but it seems to be pretty clear what the arbitrators thought of the response because they didn't adjust the reserves.
Okay, thank you.
But again, because of the way that the arbitration award was created, we don't know that.
Okay.
Your Honor, I'm rapidly coming up to the end of my unreserved time. And simply, this was a complicated and very strange matter, given the time limit that passed and given the fact that the reserves historically were proven to be accurate. There were a number of bases upon which the arbitrator could have reached this conclusion. He could have decided, yes, I'm going to include IBNR, but they should be zero. He could have rejected all the IBNR testimony and not made any adjustment. And he could have read the contract as SPX urges it could be read and as Vice Chancellor Laster said it couldn't be read.
But in essence, well, at bottom, we don't know precisely what the analysis was of the arbitrator, if any, correct?
That's correct.
So your position basically rests on, I don't mean to charge the word, but speculation. That is, raising possible rationales that the arbitrator could have adopted, none of which can be verified from the record.
That's correct, Your Honor. But I also raise, goes the other way, that the Vice Chancellor's presumption is also speculative. Because we don't know.
Well, the Vice Chancellor said, relied on, the particular language of that, is an issue here, said it's clear, there's no, it's not ambiguous, there's no alternative reading. And, that had to be applied literally, and it wasn't.
But even if you do apply it literally, you still don't know that the arbitrator didn't give operation to that provision and conclude that IBNR was zero. Because, and you also have to look at what was submitted to the arbitrator. This issue was not submitted to the arbitrator in the manner that we're talking about it now. That was argued to the arbitrator.
Well, hold on for a minute. Before you get to that, you're saying that the arbitrator, theoretically could have determined that IBNR was zero.
Correct.
Could have theoretically determined that it was twice what it actually, what was actually posted to.
Correct, Your Honor.
How do we... what kind of an opinion do we write that gives guidance in future cases in circumstances like this?
Can I just defer you a little bit? What we do know is that there was an arbitration about a reserve which history proved to be exactly correct. It resulted in no loss to any party in this case. So the arbitrator's decision was the right one. In terms of being factual, being fair, and being equitable.
If he made it.
If he made it.
If he did it on that basis.
That's what he did. I mean, that's the result of his decision. The basis of his decision is what we don't know, because it wasn't a reasoned opinion.
You want to save your remaining 2 minutes?
Certainly. Thank you.
May it please the Court, my name is Jeffrey Symes, and I represent the appellees, Garda USA and Garda World Security Corporation. In the case before the Court today, the accounting arbitrator was given a particular formula to prepare and perform a particular calculation. That formula was carefully negotiated between sophisticated business entities, and it laid out in great detail in a working capital schedule exactly what liabilities and assets had to be included and which ones had to be excluded. Now, the most significant liability, or among the most significant liabilities of Vance, the entity that was being sold, was its reserve for workers' compensation. And among the most significant components of that liability was incurred but not reported losses, IBNR. IBNR, as Justice Berger alluded to, is the concept that these claims are always growing. They're never closed. If a worker hurts his back, it's always possible in the future that that back injury will come back or will spread or will worsen. And when one sets out about quantifying the liability for workers' compensation, one must include, as a matter of actuarial science and accounting, a provision for what we call loss development, the notion that an existing claim can only expand. Now, I divert a little bit because I believe that the questions that were being asked to Mr. Fiorella are not quite getting to the essence of IBNR and its importance to these parties. The claims are not closed. True, once GARDA takes over the company, any new injury that occurs will be GARDA's problem. But the existing bucket of claims are still related to the liability for which SPX must make a provision.
That's the incurred element.
Precisely.
But the but not reported component refers to the likelihood, the probability, the prospect of those incurred claims increasing in terms of degree of exposure.
Correct. It's not reported because at this moment in time we are unaware that somebody out there has this liability. So there's an injury out there. We're not aware of it. It will incur costs in the future. It will cause injuries to worsen in the future. And therefore, it's not accurate to say at the time of closing, simply calculating the amount spent covers the liability. I dwell on IBNR because it was of critical importance to these parties. When they set forth their working capital schedule, they essentially did it in two parts. Section 1.3A is, if you will, the list of ingredients. It lays out exactly what must be included and what must be excluded. And then the remainder of that working capital schedule, Section 1.3B and C, talks about how the calculation is performed. But in 1.3A, there is an express instruction that incurred but not reported claims related to risk management programs should be excluded, quote, with the exception of those claims related to workers' compensation liabilities, which shall be included. So the parties took the time to single that out for inclusion. And despite that extremely clear agreement, that arrangement, it is undisputed that SPX did not, in its calculation of the closing working capital, include IBNR. When Ernst & Young, the accounting referee, issued its award, its exact statement was that no adjustment was required to the work that SPX done. And in fact, what it said was, E&Y has determined that no adjustment to closing date working capital is warranted for workers' compensation liabilities, as the buyer, GARDA, has not demonstrated that seller failed to comply with Section 1.3 of the working capital schedule. So there's an adoption by the accounting referee, hook, line, and sinker, if you will, of the calculation that SPX performed, which excluded IBNR.
Is the amount of the IBNR in the record? How much are we talking about here?
We're talking about several millions, Your Honor. It's Justice Jacobs, it's an important question. IBNR is a very significant component, and it's an important question for two reasons, not simply because it's a large amount, but because it relates to the fundamental questions being asked when Mr. Fiorello was talking. SPX, in its submission to the arbitrator, never mentioned IBNR. It never mentioned Section 1.3AV of the working capital schedule. It never made these arguments that the arbitrator was at liberty to disregard IBNR. In fact, its submissions to the arbitrator did not contain the term IBNR. That term never came up except in GARDA's rebuttal submission to the arbitrator, because GARDA learned for the first time upon receiving SPX's initial submission that IBNR was excluded. And so GARDA said to
during
me,
the proceeding?
During the arbitration proceeding. That fact was unknown to GARDA prior to the arbitration. It was in the arbitration, in the rebuttal submission, that GARDA said, it appears that IBNR has been excluded. Ernst & Young, please note Section 1.3AV, which requires that it be included. And we submitted certain affidavits from actuaries who said that it appears to us that the IBNR should be several million dollars based on SPX's own calculation by its actuary prior to closing. So there was some evidence in the record on IBNR, but only GARDA's evidence.
Only the order of magnitude, right?
And the reason this is important is because...
But before you get to that, once GARDA made that submission to the arbitrator, was there a response?
There was not, Your Honor. SPX never contested it. SPX never provided any basis as to why IBNR should be ignored or should be zero or should be any number different from what GARDA said. In fact, none of the submissions from SPX ever talked about IBNR, ever, at any point in time. Now, that's important because the parties' agreements limited what the accounting arbitrator could do. The accounting arbitrator was not an arbitrator with plenary powers, but rather was an arbitrator who was limited to make his decision based on the submissions of the parties. And, in fact, Section 1.3D of the agreement says that the independent accountant shall decide the issues in dispute, quote, based solely on presentations by a seller and buyer and not by independent review. And so we submit that to the extent SPX is now arguing, purely after the fact, that the accounting arbitrator could have somehow concluded sub silentio that IBNR should be zero or a number different from what Garda had suggested, we submit that the agreement prevented it from doing so. If SPX had a position on IBNR, it was obligated to submit it. It did not submit it. The accounting arbitrator did not have the liberty to do its own analysis on IBNR.
Not just the liberty, but it didn't have the power, right?
Correct. Absolutely. In fact, that is the issue, because I think if you read the Ernst & Young award, I think it's clear, at least to us on its face, that in fact what they did was simply adopt SPX's position. But if we, for some reason, assume that that's not the case, we start to get into a thorny issue as to what is the basis for the speculation that SPX has, that Ernst & Young must have analyzed IBNR and must have concluded that it's zero. The agreement would suggest that it is not entitled to do that. The agreement would also suggest that
Can I interrupt for a second? SPX must have made some submission to the arbitrator about what it hoped the arbitrator would find.
Absolutely.
And that involved some number or some argument why it should be zero or whatever, right?
Correct.
And you're saying that in that submission there was nothing about the fact that all the reserves have been paid, all the claims have been paid?
SPX's argument was simply what we call the loss reserves, the amounts paid by the insurers. And so SPX's contention to Ernst & Young is that the loss reserves equal $1.4 million. That should be the amount. That's what SPX argued. It didn't then go forward and say, okay, let's talk about other concepts, loss development, IBNR. It simply stopped at the amounts paid to date. Garda, on seeing this, went further and said, wait a minute, we have an agreement that requires more. This is insufficient. It is not enough to stop at that point because we're not dealing with the future claims. And at that point, Ernst & Young clearly understood that 1.3AV required the inclusion of IBNR. It's
okay.
In the schedule.
Did the arbitrator know as a fact that the claims had been paid and that the reserve was sufficient?
Well, Your Honor, I think
sufficient, according to SPX.
SPX certainly made the argument that the reserves were paid and it was sufficient. But what I submit to the court is that that is actuarially nonsensical. It doesn't make sense. And in fact, you can never have a claim where you say, I've paid X dollars, the liability is X. The nature of a workers' compensation claim is that there is always some amount, and often it's a very significant amount, but there's always at least some amount of liability today for things that haven't yet come into the doctor's offices. And that's the problem with SPX's position. They're basically coming to court and saying, we paid $1.4 million, we're done. And Garda's position is no, the liability is actually rather significantly more than that, because over the future history of all of these claimants, there will be, to an actuarial certainty, many hundreds of thousands of dollars more of liability that must be accounted for in this calculation.
Okay, let me ask you about this, because we hear workers' comp claims all the time, or appeals from them. Are you saying, I understand that Garda took responsibility, has the liability for all future claims after the closing date. The reserves adequately paid all the claims that came in up to the closing date.
Let me just finish,
and you can tell me where I'm wrong. Assume that one of those claimants had a broken leg and got paid for it and had time off and all that stuff, and now 8 months afterwards, that claimant has another injury. Is that something that would be on SPX or it would be on Garda because it's a new claim?
If it's a separate injury, in other words, the original injury was the leg, now he's hurt the arm, that's Garda's problem. However, if it was the leg and then it has spread, or it was the leg and now it's the leg again, then it could be SPX's liability.
Okay.
And therein lies the problem.
In other words, if it were you know, to take a horrific case, cancer, but it metastasized.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely. I mean, it's hard to put that in the workplace concept, but yes, if one had developed cancer and it had spread, then the argument would be the responsible, essentially, policy period is the SPX period. It is a liability of SPX.
You're talking about a pre-existing injury that either recurs or is somehow expanded on the job, and because its origin was this pre-existing acknowledged injury, the recurrence or the expansion are something that you need to account for in the reserve.
Correct. The liability is attributable to the point in, to the policy period in which the injury occurred. So the injury occurs, let's say, in 2013. There are recurrences in 2017, 2021. We still look back to the policy period in 2013 and say that's where the liability belongs for purposes of actuarial and accounting.
Okay, and the reserve was greater in amount than the $1.4 million.
The reserve that SPX set was roughly equivalent to the amount that had actually been paid as of that date.
Okay.
So when we say reserve, there's the workers' compensation reserve. SPX then took what is called the loss reserve, which are literally the checks written,
right,
and it summed those, and it said that is our liability.
I see. And so there never was a known established amount equal to the reserve properly calculated that was put before the arbitrator?
I'm not sure I'm following the question. I think what SPX...
Well, the problem... You know, the exclusion or inclusion of the proper amount, whatever that is, was not flagged to the arbitrator when at the time the initial submission by SPX was made.
Correct. That's right, because GARDA had no knowledge.
Okay. But your client discovered it and flagged it.
Correct.
So at that point, the arbitrator knows there is a problem. May not know what the numbers are, that is the order of magnitude, but it knows there's a problem. My question is, did there come a point that the arbitrator was also told what the order of magnitude of the problem was? Or was it simply a conceptual issue at that point?
It was more than conceptual. And I want to, without getting into too much of the granular detail, SPX had previously, just prior to closing, performed an actuarial analysis of its claims for other reasons. That analysis appears to have included IBNR. And that amount of IBNR appears to have been in the order of about $1.7 or $1.8 million.
GARDA, as opposed to the $1.4 million.
That's in addition to. So, in other words, the claims paid to date were actually less than.
So it's 3.1 or something like that.
Correct, correct. And so GARDA noted this, but again, GARDA didn't have the data to perform the full analysis. We simply noted that the evidence appeared to suggest that IBNR was substantial, and it was certain that it had been excluded from SPX's initial calculations.
So if you ask what did the arbitrator know and when did he know it, he knew there was a problem. He knew that there was at least a problem of the $1.7 million magnitude, and there was no further argument or back and forth on that issue before the decision. Is that
he was aware that Section 1.8, 1.3AV required the inclusion of IBNR. He had before him the argument by GARDA that SPX appeared not to have included it. He had the argument by GARDA that the amount appeared to be on the order of 1.7 to 1.8 million. And then he rendered his decision
without any further input from SPX.
Correct on that point, and adopting SPX's position in its entirety.
Okay. Let me try to state this simply. There had been claims made and paid that were less than the reserve. So to that extent, you could say, so far, so good, the reserves were more than adequate. But actuarially, based on the claims actually paid, you could project future payments because you knew there would be recurrences, extensions, or whatever I said. And then actuarially, it may not have been so far so good in the future because future claims could be greater. But you were able to project that with an actuarial model. And your point is that the arbitrator stopped with so far so good and didn't take into account that those claims paid to date would have a tail, so to speak, that would incur future liability.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I go a step further, because the contract required the arbitrator not to accept so far so good. In other words, even if it were the case that, great, the reserve is big enough, the contract says we have to include IBNR. So even if the arbitrator thinks, well, I don't think that's a good idea, that's not his decision to make. The parties have made that decision for him, and a calculation had to be performed that accommodated that concept.
But the point of my question was that there's a basis, in fact, for knowing you're going to have future claims, even if you've paid all the claims to date. And it's those future claims that are quantifiable, predictable, actuarially determinable,
yes,
that you need to account for.
Yes, and that, in fact, is what the parties were seeking to do by mandating the inclusion of IBNR. Unless the Court has further questions on this point, I'll move quickly to the contractual interpretation point, the argument that SPX is making that Section 1.3C of the working capital schedule, which mandates the use of historical methodologies, their argument is that that allowed it to ignore the provision in 1.3AV that said IBNR must be included. We suggest that that's simply an unreasonable interpretation. To get there, you would have to assume that sophisticated parties sat down, negotiated, and drafted careful language about including IBNR that they intended not to be used. You would have to read that language out of the agreement and suppose that they took a general provision, a provision that spoke about all assets and liabilities, and meant it to govern over a very narrow and specific provision that not only identified a single liability, but a single subcomponent of that liability.
Can I interrupt? Did SPX present this alternative reading of the contract argument to the arbitrator?
No, Your Honor. There was no discussion at all before the arbitrator of competing contractual claims. And, in fact, I will read from SPX's brief to the Chancery Court. What SPX said to the Chancery Court was that, in fact, there had never been any legal arguments. Quote, neither party made legal argument or cited case law of any kind to E&Y in connection with its consideration of the dispute. That's at page 299 of the appendix. So neither party came before the arbitrator to argue these issues because, of course, the parties had in advance told the arbitrator that he could not decide these issues. He was prohibited from deciding legal issues or interpreting the contract. And so what was before us now is an argument that SPX has advanced after the fact to attempt to justify what the arbitrator had done, which we submit does not make sense given a very clear contractual command by sophisticated parties to include a particular liability.
So if we were to hypothesize a counterfactual world in which this issue somehow did surface before the arbitrator actually got started with the proceeding and took it to court, that's an issue, would have been an issue of contract interpretation that a court could have ruled the arbitrator had no power to decide.
May I answer? I see my time is up. Absolutely, Your Honor. I think that that is certainly a question that it's our position that questions of legal interpretation under this agreement were not reserved for the accounting referee. And therefore, even if there is a valid argument, and we submit there is not one, it was not one that Ernst & Young had the privilege to decide. It was reserved for the courts by these parties.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Very briefly, during the arbitration, SPX very certainly argued that the provisions of the contract, specifically SPA Section 1.3A, 1.3C, and Seller's Disclosure Statement 1.3C, all permitted SPX to utilize the same historical basis that it had always used in connection with the reserves. This was a non-GAAP method. It was historical, and the agreement specifically allowed SPX to do this. And that's what was argued to the arbitrator, and that's what SPX believes the arbitrator was certainly entitled to take into consideration in applying SPX's consistent methodology in calculating the workers' compensation reserve.
Your point is, There was no need for any additional reserve? Is that what you're saying?
Our point is, Your Honor, that's the reserve calculation that was bargained for. That's the reserve calculation that SPX used throughout the entire transaction. Historically, it turned out to be just fine. I mean, I understand the concept that there could be claims lurking in the background that are going to arise. They haven't arisen now. We're now 2 years past that date. And I don't presume to know what the arbitrator considered in terms of the actuarial evidence that Garda produced. But he certainly had the right to reject it as being, looking at the historical basis, as just being not worthy of credence.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both. The court will take the matter under advisement and we will adjourn.